IT audits are a fact of life. We're always going to have to make sure that we're doing what we say we're doing. But sometimes it feels like we're not getting it done. And that's why IT audits lead to more harm than good. Welcome to the Tech Field Day podcast, where each time we meet, we bring together a group of IT experts and practitioners in their field to discuss or debate a topic or a premise of relevance to those in enterprise IT. This podcast is brought to you by the Tech Field Day event series. Before we introduce the premise for today's episode, I'd like to take a moment for our guests to introduce themselves, starting with Ben.
Hi, my name is Ben Story. I'm with Red Eye Network Solutions, and you can find my musings online at packitforwarding.com.
Hi, my name is Sky Fugate. I'm with NetSmart Technologies, and you can find me on LinkedIn, Sky-F.
Taryn Bryson, and I do stuff with things and other stuff.
And I am Tom Hollingsworth, part of Tech Field Day, as well as the Futurum Group. And let's jump into the premise for today's episode. If you're in security, you've had to deal with an audit. We all have. Someone has come in with a checkbox or a list of things that they need to check off, and we need to make sure that you're meeting all of the policies that are in place. And nobody likes these, right? We've had to deal with them so many times, we just roll our eyes when we hear the term auditor. And odds are good that whatever they're going to find is probably something either irrelevant or so difficult to fix that it's not even worth the time. So the premise for this episode is that audits cause more problems than they solve. You're all security people. You've all had to deal with audits. Do you like them?
Love them.
I detected a hint of sarcasm in your voice, Sky. So what is it about a security audit that just grinds your gears?
You know, it's the ability to kind of understand the environment a little bit better. There's good and bad that come with that, right? There's the ability to better understand my footprint and what's kind of out in my environment. But there's some drawbacks that come with that because there's things where we may reveal that there's non-production gear that are coming up with security vulnerabilities that we may not necessarily care about and that may not have production impact. And that kind of, you know, distracts a lot from kind of the priorities of day-to-day for the actual production stack.
Yeah, I'd contextualize audit, though, into maybe two, you know, at the macro level, maybe two types of audits, because you've got the audits that are foisted upon you by insurance companies or whatever, where they actually do come in with prescribed, things that you need to meet. But a lot of audits, you are actually audited to the policies that you have created. And so you're basically auditing, you're being audited to see if you're actually following your own rules. So that audit, if you're not doing that, you just, you know, that's an unforced error on your part.
Taryn, I'm going to have to ask, you're saying that in certain organizations, there are people who don't follow the rules?
I've heard. I mean, you know, I've never been at that organization.
So you're saying like the CEO could maybe have a different policy than the organizational standard, and I don't have to follow that. And if you flag that in an audit, well, he's the CEO. He gets away with that.
Could happen.
So in one way, like the external audit stuff we can talk about in just a minute, but let's focus on the internal audit stuff now. You're basically saying we are following the policies that we ourselves put in place. We are, you know, eating our own dog food, for lack of a better term. That to me sounds critical, like especially because you want consistency across the organization. Mm-hmm. Yet we have to do these things constantly because there's always an exception to the rule somewhere, right?
I mean, ideally not, but yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a reason why something, you know, in the policy isn't being followed. And in a lot of cases, what it is you've actually changed the policy, you know, maybe up here or you know, as far as your run books and things like that, but they haven't been updated. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of catching, you're catching mistakes, if you will. It's not so much that there's an exception because that person's special, although that could happen.
It's one of my old favorite things from the networking space. There's the desired state of truth, and then there's the actual state of truth. And if there's a gap, you need to know that.
Yep. Well, and I think those exceptions, when they do exist, it's important to know what they are and have them documented, because you can't just go by tribal knowledge and know that, oh, yeah, we let the CEO slide on that because of XYZ. because the next guy that comes into that position won't know that. So let's document it, say that the business accepted that risk. Here's what we're doing to mitigate the additional risk, if anything, and why it was approved or who approved it. You know, mm-hmm. take that onus off of the IT guy and put it onto the business that, okay, yep, business has said, yep, we're going to make this exception, and it's documented so that when that external audit shows up, they don't take your policy and go, you're not following your own policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I spend a lot of time crafting policies and getting buy-in from other, you know, folks around the organization. So the audit, I find, you know, the occasional audit I find valuable because it does, you know, point out deficiencies and gaps in process and things where, you know, something should be followed and somebody's just simply not doing it or it's fallen through the cracks. So that's, you know, I find value in that, you know, definitely. Some of the external audits that get, you know, like I said, foisted on you from different quarters, maybe those aren't quite as fun.
Let's just jump into those then, because one of the things that we've seen a lot is external parties, especially if they work with a third-party vendor or they're some kind of a regulatory body, they have certain criteria that they think that you should meet because that just makes everything better, which is how we end up with 14-character passwords that must include 5 different complexity requirements and you must change them every 30 days. And as we've learned recently, even according to places like NIST, the U.S. federal government, you should not do that because it actually causes more harm than good. With, you know, rotating your credentials too frequently just means that people are going to have to write them down anyway. And so these external things that are designed to make everything better because they're creating a baseline for security actually end up causing more problems in places where the rules are misapplied. You know, have we ever experienced that where some other organization was like suddenly, oh, you can't have a guest wireless network because it could potentially impact your PCI compliance or something like that?
Well, I think a lot of the external audits turn into checkmark fests, and it's a binary thing. It's either yes or no. There's no allowance for a gray area, but you know, things like the password complexity that you're talking about, you know, it's somebody at some point decided that was a great idea, and so it got put on all the checklists, and to comply, we still have to do that. Now, best practices now from the standards bodies is that's not the way to do it if you have MFA enabled. So, but we can't go down that path because the people that write the checklists never go back and update that.
Checklists are always additive. They're never
correct.
Refactored.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to that point, there's times where you may have a password complexity requirement, but then there's technology changes in the industry, such as passwordless entry in your accounts, and you're never really going back and retroactively updating that document. And so while, yes, it's your policy, how do we take account into the new industry best practices of, well, maybe passwordless is better, and maybe we want to start using that, but who's thinking about, oh, we need to go update that policy?
Yeah, and it's some of the big established frameworks that get updated the slowest. So like ISO 27001, how many years was that not touched, right? And it just, I think in the last year, it just got updated. So it's current now, like 2023, 2024, something like that. But where you do find a non-additive sort of policy that keeps up with the times is something we were talking about earlier, which is cyber insurance. And the reason for that is there's a lot of money on the line. So they have, you know, they have a reason basically to, you know, to keep up with the times and actually say, okay, this is the new best practice. They're not going to just have a big checkbox, you know, fest, like you said, because, it doesn't serve their purpose. You know? But yeah, some of the big frameworks and some of like SOX, you know, stuff like that. I mean, yeah, those are, I don't want to say worthless, but they're
security or compliance designed by a committee.
Yeah.
And the committee has to vote on what they think works the best. And unfortunately, we've seen over a number of years, the clean room implementation of any standard or regulatory compliance issue never survives what happens in reality. Think about something like, my favorite one is the smoker's door. It's like if I have to constantly buzz in and out of security, you know, that's a hassle for me. So a lot of places, like especially back when smoking was more in vogue, there was a door that you could just kind of go out and prop open a little bit. And, you know, you could go in and out. You didn't have to badge in and out. It was much easier. And certain penetration testers would look for those doors and wait for somebody to pop out. And then they'd have a cigarette pack in their hands. And they just slip in the door. And then they were inside the company. And they bypassed all the physical security controls.
Yep.
And auditors, right or wrong, didn't even think about that as an entry point violation. Because everyone had one.
Well, and I mean, good auditors, you know, can bring value. Right, even with bad frameworks, you know, a good auditor can get through it. But a bad auditor, I had one years and years and years ago, and it was a Sarbanes-Oxley audit. And we got, you know, we were obviously dealing with the IT portion of it. And we had our backup software, and I forget what it was, but it put up all these, you know, red X's whenever anything failed. And so she was going to fail us on this audit because of all the red X's. And I said, well, you know, these are minor files that are not being backed up. So in other words, when you back up, you know, whatever, 100,000 files and two fail, you get a red X on the, you know, because we just had the reporting threshold set pretty high. She's like, well, no, I can't pass you on that. So I said, hold on. And I made a couple changes right in front of her to the thresholds. Everything went green checkbox. She's like, oh, yeah. She's like, okay, I can pass you now.
So in your mind,
that's a bad auditor.
In your mind, what is the difference between a good and a bad auditor? What makes them a better auditor?
Well, I think knowledge, first of all. I mean, I think, you know, if you train somebody to be an auditor and they don't truly understand what they're auditing, then you get somebody who's going by the rule book and has no flexibility, no ability to understand, you know, nuance or context or anything like that. So somebody who's been in the industry, you know, as a practitioner, and has transitioned into a role like that, I think that's, you know, where you tend to get your better auditors, you know, because they actually understand what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts in your mind? What makes a good auditor or a bad auditor?
I think knowledge is the key. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not a practitioner, they actually understand what they're looking at versus just, you know, comparing, does this match this? Maybe. Okay, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and somebody that's actually able to take in the nuances of the business, and maybe if they're given a sheet where it's, all right, well, these are the assets that we have enumerated, maybe they don't take that at face value, and they actually look, and they're like, oh, well, you have XYZ router that wasn't on that list. Well, that doesn't meet your standards at all, because it's first not even in your inventory system that you gave me.
So I'll dig a little deeper in here because of other stories that I've heard. What about an auditor who believes that no company is 100% compliant and they must find something wrong? I mean, not necessarily in IT, but I've heard stories from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration that if they can't find a violation, they pull out a tape measure and start measuring railing heights because somebody in here has made a mistake and we've got to find it because nobody can be 100% compliant. Do those kinds of auditors end up causing problems because now it's not a matter of whether or not you're meeting the criteria that you've set forth for your regulatory body or your own internal policies, and now you've got a person looking for problems?
Well, I think that can, I mean, I haven't had anything that extreme happen, but, you know, the thing is when you get audited, obviously you've got a period of time after the initial findings are presented to remediate. Then they come back and they, you know, check to see if your remediations are successful. So, you know, if they're finding, you know, little ticky-tack things that, you know, really don't need to be fixed or they should be low priority, but you have to drop everything else in order to fix those things to satisfy the, you know, whatever, you know, audit you're going through, I mean, yeah, that does more harm than good, certainly. That's a waste of everybody's time. But I tend to agree with that premise, though. I think it would be very difficult for any organization to be 100% compliant with everything constantly. That's pretty impressive if they are. I've never worked for an organization like that, so maybe the problem's me.
But maybe the issue is that we have to categorize things properly. So these are major risks. These are minor risks. But as we're learning through a lot of security companies, minor risks can come back to bite us later because of newly discovered information. So, like, for example, up until about 5 years ago, having AWS API keys and clear text files in your organization wasn't a huge deal. But now that people are actively looking for that information, it's considered PII, or, you know, secret information. And if it's unstructured data, who knows what I might have out there? How many copies could have been made? You may be violating policy without even realizing it because your developer saved, you know, API key -v1-v2-final-final-don't-edit to some random corner of a SAN somewhere. And the only reason you know about it is because you now have a $10,000 AWS bill because somebody got a hold of it and has been using it. So, you know, can we unwittingly find ourselves in violation of policy because the growth of data and the ability to create these security risks has changed exponentially from the good old days when everything required a physical security key or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that's absolutely a possibility. I think that if people don't keep up with technology, you know, so, you know, for example, GitHub, most people use GitHub nowadays for, you know, storing all manner of things, not just, you know, dev software, but, you know, whatever. So GitHub has GitHub security, and, you know, I'm not advocating for any particular solution. There's others out there, but it'll actually scan for, you know, pass keys and things stored in GitHub that shouldn't be there. It'll scan for, you know, APIs that are written in such a way that somebody could exploit them. There are other tools certainly out there that do the same thing, maybe even better. But if you're not using those, if you're kind of the old school person going, well, I've got a firewall and we've got, you know, antivirus on our end user compute devices and that's good, well, you know, you're certainly in a, you know, world of hurt if anybody, you know, comes after you.
Let's talk about those kinds of solutions because we're seeing a lot of them hit the market. Data loss prevention that won't allow you to send an email with a 9-digit number that includes 2 dashes. Or, you know, a system that's constantly looking for driver's license numbers in photos that are stored on a system somewhere. Could those tools eliminate the need for audits? Because they're scanning in real time, they're constantly ensuring compliance. Do I really need somebody to come back and check now?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think those tools, I mean, automated tools are great, but, you know, they can screw up, you know, because you still have to set up the automated tool, and if you set it up wrong, you know, it just allows you to, like the old thing with automation on the networks, right? It allows you to fail faster. You know,
more completely.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and something that I've seen too is when you build those automation tools and initiatives to be able to check those things, part of the problem is you may not be able to take into account every edge case. And so there's times where an auditor would be able to say, oh, well, if you're going to meet this condition, then that fails your audit. But there's times where maybe a tool might not know how to do that, or something in the environment has evolved to where it may not understand it.
It's fair. But I think the problem is that we get back into that nuance question of, well, in this specific scenario, this particular condition is a failure. The auditor has to know what combination of factors can cause that to happen. Like we saw in a field day presentation during security field day, a particular condition with a VM could say, oh, well, this is exposed publicly, so it's a security risk, except every bit of data on that VM is encrypted. So even if it's exposed publicly, it's a low priority because even if people can get onto it, they can't read it. So, you know, are we needing to create more context around the situations that we're in to help people understand that we're still meeting the risk profile that we've created? And in doing so, how do we do it so that it doesn't look like we're trying to get off on technicalities from these audits?
Yeah, it makes me wonder as we go forward more and more with the audits and whatnot, and technology just keeps evolving so much, if we almost need to get to the point where we're sort of like home inspectors. You know, the home inspector says, well, I think this is wrong, but you should have a licensed electrician check this or a licensed plumber check this. These auditing companies, and some of them do, they have people that the auditor can reach out to and say, hey, can you help me review this? I think this is a finding, but... And, you know, so we're going to have more experts helping the expert, if that makes any sense.
our a past company I worked at, our internal audit team that ran, they mostly were there to do SOX audits before we had our external accounting team do it. They would come in, and they always brought with them a fairly senior level IT person, whether it was somebody with a network background, somebody with a systems background, but basically somebody who was in the industry and wasn't an auditor by trade. They would come along almost like when a sales rep comes out and brings an engineer with them. You know, it's like here's the person we can talk to for that context. But
right.
I haven't really seen that outside of Sarbanes-Oxley and outside of like internal audit teams at larger companies. Most of the audits that I've dealt with in recent years have been, just one auditor, or in some cases they actually just send out a form, and an officer of the company has to attest that these are all accurate, that what we're telling you, and they call it good. So I don't know how much value there is there, but
yeah, I was going to say the forms are those are the type of audits that really scare me, because you get people just going, yeah, we got that. They don't even understand the concept that they're saying that they're attesting to, which I can't fault the average CIO or CEO for not knowing every little nuance of technology. But like you said, they're attesting to it. They're putting their name on the line, in some cases with liability.
Oh yeah, legally, yes. It's legally binding.
Yeah.
So as people who have had to survive audits, what's one piece of advice that you can give to people who may be finding themselves facing their audit for the first time to help make it a positive experience for everybody? Maybe the process itself isn't positive, but we want to have a positive outcome from the audit. How can we make that happen?
Well, I always tell my team, if you talk to auditors, always, tell the truth, absolutely, because, it'll get us into a lot of trouble otherwise, but don't volunteer more than you've been asked. And the example I use is, if somebody says, do you know what time it is, the proper answer is yes or no. Most people, what do? When you
tell
ask
you
what
time
it is, they tell you the time. Or, do you know the time? And say yes, and they tell it to you. That's giving more information than was asked. And that's what I, tell my team, because auditors, they'll ask a question, and then somebody will start blabbing about all of a sudden, they're like, oh, that's interesting. And you've just expanded the scope of the audit. So
it's the courtroom answer. Answer the question that was asked.
Yep.
Sky?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I can say is assume positive intent in the audit, right? At the end of the day, we're not trying to just discover everything just to shut down the company. That's not the ultimate goal of it. It's really to improve your environment and make sure that you're doing what you're saying you're supposed to be doing. And just be open to kind of what those results are. That way you're, doing the best job that you can for your environment.
Yeah. I think positive intent is a good way of putting it. And being open to the, I don't know if suggestions is the right word, or the findings, just being open to the findings, because it's an iterative process. Security is constant. The day that you stop trying to update your security is the day you probably got breached, because you stopped changing. I wish that the standards bodies and the auditor forms or whatever they're using kept up, but it is what it is.
Well, and I wish our policies kept up.
Ultimately, an audit is the second half of the maxim, trust but verify. We need to make sure that we're doing what we say we're doing, whether it is our own policies or somebody else's external policies. There's a lot of nuance, there's a lot of understanding, there's a lot of knowledge that goes into that. But you have to be sure that everything is working the way that it's supposed to. And yes, a big list of checkboxes that need to be fixed equates to a lot of extra work, equates to a lot of soul searching on the behalf of you and the people who craft the policy. But at the end of the day, it's better to have to uncheck those boxes now than to have to answer those hard questions in a legal proceeding or the news, and nobody wants that. That'll do it for this episode of the Tech Field Day podcast. I want to thank everyone out there for tuning in. If our guests would be so kind as to tell us, where can we find more about the things that you do online? Ben?
I blog at packitforwarding.com or on X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, at NTWRK80.
Yep, and I'm Sky Fugate on LinkedIn, LinkedIn/my/Sky-F, or online at FugateOnline.com.
Yeah, and I'm on LinkedIn as well, Taryn Bryson, easily found on most of the major social media platforms and even some of the minor ones under either Some Clown or Just Some Clown. And I have a blog that I am rekindling. It's been a little out of date lately, but that's at blog.packetq.net.
And if you're interested in following along with the content that we create here, make sure you check out techfieldday.com/podcast for the latest episode. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel and to our podcast in your favorite podcatcher of choice. Just search for Tech Field Day Podcast. We'll be back with another episode next week, so stay tuned. Until then, take care.